Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today, we're going to learn about how you can prevent one of the worst cancers, colorectal cancer. Also, your DNA is actually impacted by loneliness. Going to improve your blood flow, bone density, and alleviate menopausal symptoms with just one single herb. Amazing benefits of fennel seed, and a study sheds light on how turmeric can protect the aging brain from decline, plus a lot more. Our classroom on the air, which is a more comprehensive look at a nutrient, will be on testing for C-reactive protein. Now, most people have never been tested, don't know what it is, but it could save your life. Sue Simmons on that. Then a lot of short commentaries. The corporate gods of greed, the land of opportunity, from Robert Fantina. How five American companies control what you think, Eric Summers from Global Research. How parasite corporations like Pfizer are affecting U.S. citizenship to escape from taxes. And the Trans-Pacific Partnership is another upward transfer of wealth. Very important. We'll take a look at that. I'm going to take a look at the New York Times. If you're watching, and you can watch this program by going to ustream.tv and search for Gary Null. This is the New York Times today. One half, about 70% of the page, what farm-to-table got wrong? It's from David Barber, and it says, it's spring again, hip-deep in asparagus, and soon enough, tomatoes and zucchini. Farm-to-table advocates finally have something from the farm to put on the table. The crowds clamoring for just-dug produce at the farmer's market, and the local food co-op suggests that this movement is no longer just a foodie fad. Today, almost 80% of Americans say sustainability is a priority when purchasing food. The promise of this kind of majority is that eating local can reshape landscapes and drive lasting change. Except, it hasn't. All right, we'll take a look and give a different perspective than what this writer has from the New York Times. If time permits, I'll offer a challenge to the Federal Reserve and to all the journalists in America who missed this story about how we have been artificially living in a bubble created by the Federal Reserve, and how everything you were told about the quantitative easing, meaning giving all the major institutions, financial institutions, hundreds of billions of dollars, but didn't give us anything. What's the truth of all that? So as you see, we have something for everyone. Let's begin. And I will be taking calls throughout the program. The number is 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. A new study published in the peer-reviewed journal Cellular Physiology and Biochemistry shows that turmeric, and that's where we get curry powders, as well established, it has cancer-fighting properties, it can help treat depression, and a newer study indicates that the bright yellow root could also protect the brain from age-related dysfunctions, including stroke, dementia, and neurodegenerative disease like Alzheimer and Parkinson's. The study used a group of laboratory rats, and they found, quote, remarkable restoration in brain function and impaired cerebrovascular endothelium-dependent vasorelaxation. In lay language, the ability of the vessels in the brain to relax and allow blood to flow freely. In addition, curcumin promoted phosphorylation, which is related to improved endothelial function and cardiovascular risk factors, and also reduce the production of reactive oxygen species, which are associated with decreased oxygen, oxidative stress, cell damage. Quote, in summary, our findings provide the first evidence that chronic activation of different pathways by curcumin treatment may be effective therapeutic strategy to reverse age-related cerebrovascular dysfunction. Curcumin administration may present a promising lifestyle intervention for preventing age-related cerebrovascular disturbances. All right. In lay language, what this means is we now have over 100 million Americans who are over the age of 40. And as these people age, so does their brain. And because people have been exposed to surgeries, which can cause AFib, which can cause micro strokes in the brain, which are not detectable by currently any real means that we have. A stroke, yes. A minor stroke, yes. But microscopes, no. And then that ages the brain. We begin to kill cells in the brain. Alcohol does that. Toxic chemicals does it. Pesticides can do it. Having a cell phone up by your ear all the time, that can do it. And then we look at our lifestyle and we do a lot of stuff that we shouldn't. And sometimes we wake up and we realize these are bad choices. And then we start to eat better, make positive choices. But that eating better and making positive choices will not reverse the damage. That requires specific protocols. But can we? Yes, we can. We can change the brain. In effect, we can rejuvenate the brain. And curcumin from turmeric is one of the ways you can do it. Fennel seed is not used much in the United States. It should be. It's very flavorful. It's very aromatic. It comes originally from the Mediterranean region. Now, in India and other countries, they'll use fennel. Like, they'll take a quarter of a teaspoon and chew on it afterwards. It helps with digestion. And it's very sweet. But there's more that it does. It can reduce gas, bloating. The seed's high volatile oil content, fenchone, and estragon are the main substances that effectively clear internal gas. So if you have a problem with gas, definitely chew on some fennel seeds, and that will make a difference. Or just have a tea after a meal, small tea, lukewarm, never hot, and put fennel seed or fennel powder in it. Stir it around, drink it, that'll help with the gas problem. And also it decreases colic in babies. And that was published in a peer-reviewed article in Alternative Therapies in Health and Medicine. They compared a placebo administering fennel seed oil emulsion orally to infants with colic and found it could reduce their symptoms and improve their condition. And this provides an important, safe, natural way of helping versus the chemical version that is used on colic. And they also, aside from helping with flatulence and colic, they help to relax the stomach. So if you have a what's called a butterfly stomach or a frequent indigestion, that'll help. Here's something that will help improve your blood flow, improve bone density, and alleviates menopausal symptoms. It's red clover. Now, red clover originally came from Europe and Africa and Northern Asia. Now it's grown in the United States. And the plants are believed to have helped soils by adjusting their nitrogen levels. Hence, they are more fertile soil. But it's a great source of nutrients, calcium, potassium, niacin, vitamin C, and isoflavones, and phytoestrogens that mimic women's estrogens by helping to minimize the unpleasant effects caused by menstruation and, most importantly, menopause. Now, according to Natural News, the red clover has been used internally just as much as externally to treat ailments. It can often be found packaged in various balms in order to treat skin conditions like eczema and psoriasis and sores and burns. It has a very potent anti-inflammatory and pain-relieving, even blood-purifying and blood-thinning properties. And it's got caffeic acid and chlorogenic acid and coumarin, ginseng. These are all important. And it also helps, according to the latest study done at the University of Singapore, it helps to increase the density of your bones. That means it helps prevent osteoporosis. And that's a really good thing. And also it's been helping women with menopausal symptoms for a long time. It'll help alleviate some of the estrogen-related symptoms as breast pain that happens in PMS. It can also help prevent cancer around the lining of the uterus. They tested on 1,000 women and showed that it interfered with the action of specific enzymes known to encourage endometrial cancer. So, very important. Red clover. We've all gone through periods of loneliness in our life. I think it is very important to have a quality, unconditional, loving relationship. But we also shouldn't fall apart if we don't have one. And too often we get in the wrong relationships and then end up suffering because of it. And then our life becomes revolved around the crisis of the relationship. Relationships shouldn't be about crisis or control or changing someone. It should be about enjoying the best that we are as a human being with another person. And some people are blessed by having such relationships, but the vast majority of people are not. And so we feel if we're not in a relationship that, you know, woe is us, and loneliness overtakes people. Here's the impact of loneliness, a new study, one of the many impacts. They found that loneliness impacts DNA repair, and that's not good. It also means that when they studied the telomeres, they were shortening with each cell division. And of course, we know that as the telomeres on the chromosomes, the endochromosomes, get too short, there is then what is called replicative senescence, meaning cell death. You simply wear out your cells. But loneliness, now in this study, shows to contribute to aging and death. So several studies have shown that telomere shortening is accelerated by stress. But not only stress that you create, but stress of the environment that you're in. Let me explain this. Let's just say that we work in an environment that we're not entirely happy with. Maybe we're not paid what we should be. Maybe we're not doing the work we were trained to do. That's happened with a lot of younger people now. Or older people who were comfortable and did good work and then lost their job, downsized, and now have to take some other kind of work that they're not happy with. Then they walk around personalizing it all the time. That creates chronic stress. That chronic stress manifests in the body as distress. Distress raises your stress hormones like cortisol, epinephrine, and it'll exhaust your adrenal glands. Now you walk around fatigued. You don't have the vitality, the energy, the libido you once had. Your passion for things that used to excite you now don't. Used to go to places or be with friends more often, now you're less likely. That all happens when you feel stressed, because people feel, they don't feel empowered by stress. They feel disempowered by it. So look at where the stress is emanating and then just start the process of saying, I'm going to stop personalizing everything. It's when we act like a sponge, an emotional sponge, we bring everything in instead of simply saying, all I'm dealing with right now is that I have some information. Let me just see how I can deal with this information. What options, what solutions are there for the information? It's much healthier, and it'll de-stress you. But But now, when we're lonely and we're stressed because we're lonely, that's a double negative. And now we're finding out that that shortens our telomeres, speeds up our aging process, and hastens our death. And it's also creating erosion of the DNA. Quote, studies on humans suggest that people who have experienced high levels of social stress and deprivation have shorter telomeres. So, but this study is, quote, the first to examine the effects of social isolation on telomere length in any species. And it shows it not good. So, this was done at the Department of Biomedical Sciences at the FetMundi in Vienna, Austria. My suggestion is that we should try to find those who we can do something with. Interesting, recently, as a fundraiser for our sister station, WBAI, I suggested an evening out, dinner and a Broadway play or an art film. And it was about 6 hours, and it was an enormous success. It raised lots of money for the station. I donated my time, which I was happy to do. The people were just absolutely to a person. They were just joyful and happy. Most were single, some couples. But then one of them at the end of the evening said, you know, I would never have done this on my own. Why not? Well, because I would have, if I was in a relationship, yeah, I'd go to dinner, I'd go to play, but I just don't feel comfortable doing it on my own. I said, but why not? Think of all that you could have enjoyed if no one else was here. The meal you could have enjoyed, the walk down Broadway, going to Lincoln Center, seeing the Moss Hart biography play, Act One, which is very good, I recommend it, and walking back uptown, having a dessert. You could do that. I do that all the time. And so one of the other people said, yeah, I do that. I'm not going to sit around anymore and stay on my computer till I fall asleep because I'm lonely. So I'm thinking, why don't you, I said to the person, why don't you start a website for people who want to do something, at least to be around other human beings, maybe create some friendships or relationships. Like what? I said, well, why not have a culture night? Find something that you and other people and put it out there. It's a concert at the Beacon Theater if you're in Manhattan, but wherever you live, you could do it in your area. And or it's to see a particular film and put out a list of 10 films. Who would like to join me to see these films? Then have people contact you. But before they do, of course, let them, you know, get to know the people, see who they are, meet in public places. And then from that, you create a little core of people, and it can grow. Because at least you're sharing something you like to do with people that you may end up befriending. So I don't think that we have to spend all of our time lonely, prematurely aging ourselves, shortening our telomeres, spending wasted time on a computer, sitting talking with someone on the phone, just because we don't have anything better to do. I think you have to be proactive, I think you have to be creative, and you can create some wonderful times with other people in a safe and what a magnificent cultural environment New York is to begin with. Magnesium lowers colorectal cancer risk. This is an important quote. An astounding 70% or more of Americans are deficient in the essential mineral magnesium. Low levels can have deadly effects. This is according to Green Med Info. Margie King, quote, epidemiological studies have suggested that low magnesium may be associated with higher rates of colorectal cancer, among other diseases. Now new meta-analysis, that means many studies, confirms that higher magnesium intakes are associated with a lower risk of colorectal cancer, and especially colon cancer. And this was looking at 338,000 participants, published in the European Journal of Clinical Nutrition. So, my suggestion is 400 milligrams a day in men and women. And also, you could get some from dried seaweed, dark green vegetables, Swiss chard, broccoli, beans, brown rice, quinoa, almonds, cashews, sesame seeds, lentils, and avocado. They're all good, and we need more of them. Now, for a more in-depth discussion, I would like to see everyone over the age of 40, twice a year, get an inexpensive and simple and painless test. It is a C-reactive protein. Now, C-reactive protein is important. It's long been used as a marker for inflammation in the body. If it's elevated, then that's a bad thing because it increases your risk of heart attacks and strokes and cancer and diabetes substantially. But if it's not high, and that's good, and you should know that because that reduces one of your risk factors for having a heart attack or stroke. And everything we can do to reduce the risk factors is important. For example, when you reverse or reduce glycation in the diet, that means taking in cooked, heavily cooked proteins and carbohydrates, like a hot dog in a bun, a pizza, a steak and bread. Those are carbohydrates and proteins that contribute to inflammation and contribute to heart disease. When you have alcohol, it contributes to heart disease. When you have fried foods, again, it contributes. Sugars contributes. So each one of these that you get rid of, you're preventing that condition in your body, and that's good. Now, C-reactive protein is manufactured throughout the body, especially by immune cells, the liver, and by fat cells. And during the early phase of an inflammatory stimulus, like an infection, they rise dramatically, C-reactive protein. They're very sensitive and robust markers of general inflammation. But you don't want it staying up there. That's where you get it in trouble. So get it tested, and then when you do, if it's elevated, then there's programs you can go on to reduce it safely. I saw one study. Women with the highest C-reactive protein had a 1,600% higher risk of developing diabetes. In another study, the risk was about 300% in men and women. And so we can do something about it. How would you reduce it? Well, go on a vegan diet, have lots of juices, vitamin C, B-complex, B12 at higher doses, folic acid, and that's how you reduce your risk. Now, I'm going to take some calls here in a moment, but I'm going to share a few commentaries and then get your feedback. First, I'm going to go to this New York Times from today. What Farm to Table Got Wrong? And this is by Dan Barber. What he's saying in here, and I'm not taking issue with the article itself. I think he has his facts right, but it's limited. In other words, he's saying that it would be great if farmers grew all organic, and but they wouldn't. They'd be going out of business because the majority of Americans, they want animal proteins. So 70% even of organic farms are growing foods like soy and corn to feed to cattle and pigs and chickens and other animals. And therefore, they don't have the variety of crops. And he says that there has been, this is a substantial number, by the way, more than one, quote, in the last 5 years, we've lost nearly 100,000 farms, mainly mid-size. Today, 1.1% of farms in the United States account for nearly 45% of farm revenues. Despite being farm-to-table's favorite targets, corn and soy account for nearly 50% of our harvested acres for the first time ever. Between 2006 and 2011, over 1 million acres of native prairie were plowed up in the so-called Western Corn Belt to make way for these two crops, the most rapid loss of grassland since we started using tractors to bust sod on the Great Plains in the 1920s. How do we make sense of this odd duality, a food revolution on the one hand and an entrenched status quo on the other? All right, here's what's not in here. The answer is on two levels. First, He gave part of it when he said 100,000 farms have gone broke. Why? Because these are farms that more often than not were monocrop farms, a single crop. Secondly, they had been given some guarantees. They used pesticides, herbicides, fungicides a great deal. They frequently had long winters and had severe drought, and in the springtime when the rains come, they could flood away the good quality soil, so they were having to add more and more artificial fertilizer to get their crop. But there has been an enormous growth in small organic farms and smaller farms that are working with food co-ops and with small groups of people, where you go to the farmer and you say, here's a list of the things that we would like you to grow for us. In return, we're going to give you this money up front that will buy your seed and help you get it planted. Well, that's an enormous benefit to the farmer who might otherwise have had gone to a bank and taken out a loan and pay a heavy interest on it. And that way, they'll grow exactly what you want, how you want it. So that part of the story is not being told, because yesterday when I was at the farmer's market, there are more organic stands than ever before, and it's only going to continue to grow. But it's only going to grow in the small farm, and the mid-size are going to go out of business, and the giant commercial farms are going to continue growing. The problem is most Americans want animal proteins. The movement should be for hydroponic, because with hydroponic, you don't have to worry about the soil, the pesticides, the herbicides, the fungicides, the artificial fertilizers. You don't have to think about the weather, the coldest day, the rainiest day, the hottest day, the drought. The person today who wants to change businesses, I could think of no business that would be more successful for you than hydroponics. And mark my words, within 5 years, we'll probably have 50, 75, 100,000 people around the United States using hydroponics. Start small. Start to test it for a season, a year in your backyard. They're inexpensive. But this way, you control 12 months a year. Now, just imagine that you are a medium-sized farmer and the rains came heavy, like in Iowa, and too hard, and they washed out a lot of seed. And then right behind that comes summer, and the hottest summer on record, which dries out your crop, and then you lose about a half your crop. And now winter comes, and you get the coldest day, and yet you're having to be limited to that one crop growing for that one harvest. Now you know why they're going out of business. Now imagine that you would have your own crops that you're growing 12 months a year. And if you doubt me on this, simply start growing sprouts and microgreens. Sprouts can grow anywhere from 3 to 10 days. And you'll have an enormous market at the farmer's market for that. Then grow wheatgrass, sell it to health food stores. Then grow microgreens, sell them to restaurants. This is the future. Get ahead of the curve if you want to succeed. Later in the summer, I'll be building a hydroponic house, filming it, and every day putting it up on the internet so you can watch what is done. And hopefully, even in your own backyard, do the same thing. Because I'll show you how to make it all energy efficient, how to use natural resources, natural materials, non-polluting, how to grow organic. So it's not difficult. Just have to learn and then watch how your life can change for the better. So you see, that's the part of the story that the New York Times didn't talk about. And also, I believe that we should have a major vegan movement to educate more Americans about where their food comes from, why even going organic with meat is not the ideal, but rather vegan, and how much that will mean to bring more farms online to grow food organically, non-GMO food for human consumption. But you first have to have an education program. And remember, we're up against hundreds of billions of dollars a year spent on on animal proteins and advertising, the dairy, the meat, the beef, and all the rest. So it'll take a while. People won't change their habits immediately. So then we also have to show people how you can make foods that they like the mouthfeel, the smell, the taste, so it's not something so alien to them. So we have a lot of work ahead, but we'll do it. We're putting in the effort right now on non-GMOs, and then it's movement back to the land. I'm Gary Noll. Nice to have you with us today. Taking a break, coming back, and taking your calls. 888-874-4888. Say hello to Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have an email here, just to change the subject a little bit. You know, I get a lot of emails people asking medical questions, but I think this one is going to be appropriate for a lot of your listeners. This comes from Carla, and she says, I am now 47, and though I've been in pretty good health, I find that my body is changing. And she says, my partner is 49, and he's kind of developed that pot belly that he never had before. And she said, I heard that you mentioned there were some tests that we can take, both men and women, to help us to figure out what's going on at this time in our life.
Yes, I just mentioned that a little earlier. I mentioned one test, a C-reactive protein, but for women, I believe women should have a lipid profile, meaning total cholesterol, the LDL, which is the low-density lipoprotein, the HDL, the high-density lipoprotein, and triglycerides. Because if those are elevated, any one or two of them, you're at greater risk of a heart attack or stroke. Then you want the two that are cardiovascular markers, C-reactive protein and homocysteine. Then women should all have the hormone, meaning progesterone, estradiol, it's an estrogen, and free and total testosterone, DHEA, and thyroid function, which is TSH, and then also vitamin D, because most women are deficient in vitamin D and have underactive thyroids. And then for those who may be overweight or have be a precursor for diabetes, they should have the metabolic profile, meaning your glucose, your kidney tests, like your bun test, uric acid, and liver function, the AST, ALT, LDH, GGT, bilirubin, alkaline phosphatase, your mineral test, mainly potassium, calcium, phosphorus, sodium, chloride, and iron, and then your complete blood count, meaning red blood cells, including hemoglobin, and MCV, MCH, MCHC, and white blood cell, and lymphocytes, monocytes, neutrophils, and basophils. So those would help a woman, and especially after the age of 40. For men, they want the same cholesterol, they want the same cardiac. With men, it's the free testosterone and DHEAS, and the estradiol, an estrogen, because men have it. And then, so pretty much they're getting the same function test. So that's what I would suggest. And that way they won't have to guess what's going on in their body, they'll be able to know. Let's say you're a giant American corporation like Pfizer, founded in Brooklyn way back in 1849. The fact that you exist and make a profit is largely due to the generous support of U.S. taxpayers. It is the taxpayers, after all, who pony up for all the National Institutes of Health, which does the basic research you rely upon to develop drugs on which you make giant sums. And it's the taxpayers who shell out large amounts of money to protect your patents and broker trade treaties in your favor and protect your interests around the world in international negotiations. The same ones who pay for the public education of your employees and the costly infrastructure, the highways, the airports, needed to move your products. The very folks who pay the billions in federal contracts you receive. So what do you do? Do you pay your share of taxes in return? No. You vigorously lobby for lower taxes and leave no loophole unexploited. You're not satisfied to have received $2.2 billion in federal taxes last year while raking in $43 billion worldwide, even though 40% of your sales are in America. You're not ashamed in the least that you stashed $73 billion in profits offshore on which you paid zero in U.S. income taxes. Your greed and irresponsibility demand still more. So you decide to get out of paying a single nickel to the country that feeds you. You rig up an overseas purchase so you can officially relocate to a place with a lower tax rate, and in doing so, deliver a giant middle finger to your fellow Americans. Last week, New York-based drug maker Pfizer finally admitted why it wants to buy British drug maker AstraZeneca, which is based in London. Sure, it'll get some experimental drugs out of the deal, but that's not what's really after. What Pfizer wants is to cheat American taxpayers. Ian Reed, the CEO, should be in the Hall of Shame. Pfizer's willing to shell out $100 billion for AstraZeneca so it can get a new tax home and lower its tax rate from roughly 27% it paid last year to the UK tax rate, which is now 21%, will drop to 20% next year. Let's pause for a moment to consider the CEO of Pfizer, Ian Reed, who is orchestrating this move. According to Forbes, he is a poster boy for grossly overblown executive salaries, hauling in almost $19 million last year. Reed looted the company for this obscene amount of money, despite the fact that under his leadership, profits actually declined in 2013. So instead of trying to make money by doing productive things, like, for example, investing in research and development for new products, Reed is looking for shortcuts that are less about doing anything useful for society and more about plain taking away money. Right on cue, Reed trotted out the predictable nonsense that he has a fiduciary responsibility to maximize value for Pfizer shareholders and therefore must make the tax-dodging move. Actually, this is baloney. As economist William Lazanek has repeatedly pointed out, shareholder value ideology is merely an absurdity that has been spread through American business schools since the go-go of 1980s, a specious justification that allows executives to turn corporations into predatory extraction machines at the expense of stakeholders like workers and taxpayers. The fiduciary duty to shareholders argument would be laughed out of court in nearly all circumstances. The reason for this is simple. Any idiot can figure out that sometimes a company must take short-term profit hits in order to do things that are in the long-term interest of the company. There was a time when an American CEO would not dare to officially state the kind of complete disregard for the public that Reed is expressing. We can't underestimate the importance of shaming such parasitical creatures for daring to do so now. Social norms matter for things like executive compensation and the consideration of stakeholders rather than just shareholders, people who own stock. Reed should be more of a human being and made to feel that there is nothing normal or acceptable about his twisted logic. In conclusion, Reed said that Pfizer would keep its corporate headquarters in the United States, a very swanky affair on 42nd Street in Manhattan, and keep its listing on the New York Stock Exchange, which essentially means that his company will still be located in the place where it will not be paying any taxes, which would make Pfizer a giant blood-sucking parasite. Of course, part of the problem is that mega companies in other industries like Boeing actually pay no taxes at all. And that makes Pfizer very upset. If other multinationals get off scot-free, why can't they? H. David Rosenblum, an attorney at Kaplan and Drysdale, Washington, and director of the International Tax Program at New York University's Law School, explained his view of Pfizer's plan to Bloomberg. Quote, "This is basically an opportunity to go outside the United States, still sell in the United States, and strip the tax base. If we ever had a legislature in the United States, we would do something about this, but I don't expect to live that long," end quote. Which brings us to the question of what can be done about this looting. Some Democrats, like Carl Levin, are making noises about curbing offshore tax moves in wake of Pfizer's announcement. Will anything happen? Doubtful. Passing any meaningful legislation on international tax policy, as Rosenblum points out, is all but impossible in a deadlock Congress. Since countries around the world are basically in a race to the bottom to lower corporate tax rates, causing companies to shift their tax burden by pretending to set up shop in places like Ireland, Switzerland, and Bermuda, it may be that trying to collect corporate taxes is going to be a futile exercise in the future. So, that's what he has to say. And I would agree with that. I just believe that how we stop all this nonsense and the 58,000-page tax code and all these corporate lawyers that get them to pay no taxes, actually get refunds, all the while making their money in the United States, is that you simply have one flat corporate tax that nobody can get out of, no matter where you are in the world, no matter where your products are sold in the world. Everybody who's a corporation must pay the same percentage. But make it low. Make it, let's say, 15%. That's lower than what it would be, and that way they have to pay it. Do you realize, do the math, of all these major corporations don't pay a penny and make billions of dollars, that would bring us over $2 trillion in additional revenue. And then for every transaction, every one of the electronic trades on Wall Street, charge a simple 2% fee, 2% of every trade, that would bring us an additional $1 trillion, and no one being able to avoid those taxes. So you see, that would stop all the nonsense. You wouldn't even need an Internal Revenue Service. You could stop all the bureaucracy, having keep all the receipts. We're not going to do it, but we should do it. Instead, we'll play this strange game of saying we want all these corporations to be paying less, and then they hire the legislators to do it for them. Finally, The Corporate Gods of America, The Land of Opportunity by Robert Fantina. Can anyone doubt that the United States is governed for corporate good? The lofty concept of for the people evaporated into mythical fairy dust generations ago. In the new millennium, any pretense to serve the people rather than the corporation has been swept away. Apparently, the elected so-called representatives and the corporations who own them are convinced that the 99% are sufficiently lulled into a belief that the U.S. is the greatest country in the world and what's good for business is good for them. Those with that bizarre belief overlook some very basic and rudimentary facts. 1. Safety laws. Opposed by corporations, lax or non-existent safety laws benefit the corporate bottom line at the expense of the individual. Cramming more workers into a factory may jeopardize their health in a number of ways, but more workers produce more goods, and that's good for the corporations. Pollution standards. Such standards allow millions of people to live in at least acceptable air quality and to be comfortably drinking tap water. Yet requiring corporations to reduce the amount of waste they unleash into the air and water costs them money without bringing any financial return. With no return on their investment, corporations oppose such standards. A low minimum wage. Keeping the minimum wage low increases corporate profits while keeping countless individuals and families in poverty. Another plus for corporations. It enables corporate executives to receive multi-million-dollar salaries and bonuses while their employees can barely afford food, let alone such luxuries as higher education for themselves and their children. Offshore, taking all corporations offshore. The practice of many, if not most, large corporations of sending jobs to nations that pay nearly slave wages with no safety standards also helps profiteers while depriving millions of American citizens of employment. The damage to the health and well-being of the foreign workers is not even a consideration for the corporations whose work they do. Destroying or weakening unions, for generations, workers united were able to improve their lot through collective bargaining. Now, however, corporations, along with the government officials they have bought and paid for, strive to weaken or destroy unions. And corporate control of the media. Five corporations control 90% of the U.S. media. And they reach 277 American citizens. That's power. I'm Gary Nall. We're out of time. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. We'll see you later.